him, you know, after he was found at the drug party. So there was an element of admission that he had done something wrong. And then when he became, she became the vice president and head of the Department of Education, she is now back. This person is now back as her press relations and officer and head of her media office. So basically,
Walden, before we go, I want to make sure you can comment overall on the new government that is headed by the son of the former dictator, that is headed by Bongbong, by Marcos Jr., and Sara Duterte, the son of the previous president.
Yes. Let me just say that people are really, really quite worried that this is a foretaste of things to come. Because just, you know, a few weeks after the new government was inaugurated, there is this effort to intimidate the opposition by filing the cyber libel case. And by the way, my my case must be seen in the context of thousands of cyber libel cases. I think the estimate is 4,000 that have been lodged by politicians against their opponents over the last few years. The most prominent, of course, is the way that the father of Sara Duterte had cyber libel cases filed against Maria Ressa, the head of Rappler, who won the Nobel Prize, incidentally. But I guess what people are now saying is that, you know, it's only been a few weeks and they're showing their fangs at this point in time. And that's true. I think that this was, of course, aimed at me, but the implications are much larger, and I am being made an object lesson of what can happen if somebody dares to criticize a person in high office, somebody in high office in this administration. So I think, Amy, this is the reason why this has sparked so much domestic outrage as well as international outrage, because, you know, people, you know, really feel, you know, that this weaponization of the law, like the cyber libel, is something that has become the modus operandi of these heads of government and officials that really do not like criticism. So, you know, the people that you talk to, you know, throughout the whole range of the society here, throughout the opposition, they have come together on this on this case, because they know that if they win this case, if the administration you know, wins this case in the judiciary, and it's likely that it will win this case because it has a very strong control over judiciary, then people really feel that democratic rights are in very grave danger. That is what is at stake here at the moment, and I think people see it, which is why they've come together to demand that the administration, the Secretary of Justice at this point, just drop this charge against me.
Well, Walden Bello, of course, will continue to cover your case. Walden Bello, acclaimed Filipino scholar, activist, former vice presidential candidate in the Philippines, co-founded Focus on the Global South, arrested Monday and charged with cyber libel charges. He was released from police custody on Tuesday. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a people and culture manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke. Welcome back, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlin. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Stelly, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
SPAC Brothers Pizza joins you in supporting WRCT Pittsburgh. SPAC Brothers offers the finest pizza, hoagies, and wings while specializing in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. SPAC Bros is committed to offering quality food with an emphasis on locally grown sustainable agriculture. SPAC Brothers Pizza is located at 5107 Penn Avenue in the Garfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. For more information, call 412-362-SPAC or visit their website at spacbrothers.com. That is S-P-A-K brothers.com. Rita's Italian Ice joins you in supporting WRCT. Rita's offers a variety of frozen treats, including its famous Italian Ice, made fresh daily with real fruit, available in over 80 flavors. You can visit Rita's at 3712 Fifth Avenue near the University of Pittsburgh campus. For more information, visit their website at www.ritasice.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, one of the biggest political stories of the year, of the decade, of the entire time that I've been covering politics took place last night, August 8th, the anniversary of the resignation of President Richard Nixon from his office. The FBI executed a search warrant at Donald Trump's home, Mar-a-Lago, including a search of his personal quarters, as well as of a safe. It is an incredible situation, this all happening in connection with Donald Trump taking those massive dumps of classified documents to his own house. NBC reporting, FBI search at Trump's Mar-a-Lago home tied to classified material. In a lengthy statement Monday night, Trump said they even broke into my safe. Former President Trump said Monday the FBI raided his home at Mar-a-Lago and cracked his safe. A source familiar with the matter said to NBC News it was all tied to the classified information that Donald Trump took with him from the White House in January of 2021. This is an extraordinary situation. The claims being made by those on the right are beyond parody, and we will get to that. But first and foremost, Donald Trump's own reaction to this, putting out an unhinged statement saying the following: these are dark times for our nation. As my beautiful home, Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida, is currently under siege, raided and occupied by a large group of FBI agents. Nothing like this has ever happened to a president of the United States before. After working and cooperating with the relevant government agencies, this unannounced raid on my home was not necessary or appropriate. The fact that Trump is saying he was cooperating to me suggests he wasn't, because he basically lies about everything. It is a prosecutorial misconduct, the weaponization of the justice system, and an attack by radical left Democrats who desperately don't want me to run for president in 2024, especially based on recent polls. Now, remember, the current director of the FBI is Christopher Wray, appointed by Donald Trump. So to claim that this is the work of far left Democrats, it is being asserted without evidence, and until evidence is presented, I believe we can dismiss it, as there is no evidence. Trump going on to say such an assault could only take place in broken third world countries. Sadly, America has now become one of those capital C countries, corrupt at a level not seen before. Wow. They even broke into my safe. What is the difference between this and Watergate, where operatives broke into the DNC? Here in reverse, Democrats broke into the home of the 45th president of the United States.
Big, massive dumps.
Well, that's all going to remain to be seen. I do hope, given Trump's propensity to flush evidence down the toilet, I hope the FBI has plumbers on staff and that they have appropriate elements of plumbing with suction in order to figure out what on earth did Trump flush down that toilet? What records did he destroy? So, Trump blaming this on the radical left. The truth is, Trump selected the FBI director who would have had to sign off on this. And just as a reminder, here is Donald Trump praising the great Christopher Wray from the FBI.
President Trump is just tweeting about the FBI director. Here's what he says: I will be nominating Christopher A. Wray, a man of impeccable credentials, to be the next director of the FBI. Details to follow.
Right. That's the guy now that Trump is saying is the radical left going after him. Now, understand, such a decision to raid the house of a former president, it must have been approved by the Attorney General Merrick Garland. The top echelon of the FBI must have known about it. That is one, very bad news for Donald Trump. And second, you don't do this on a whim. The FBI also would have required probable cause, to have a belief that there were specific places, again, Trump's personal quarters, Trump's safe. They would have to have probable cause to be able to say, here's where we want to search. It wouldn't be a shock if a very high level Trump associate flipped and was cooperating with the FBI. We don't know that. But for them to have such probable cause about the specific places in Trump's home to be searched, could it have been Mark Meadows? We don't know. It's all speculative. But the most important part of this is that when Trump says they broke into my safe, and later you'll hear Eric Trump say there was nothing in it, which is interesting, they would need some reason to include the safe as a search location. They would have some reason to think that the safe might have a nexus to potentially criminal activity. Now, if the raid was only about some low-level staffer and not about Trump or someone near Trump, it's unlikely they would go into his personal safe. Again, we're reading tea leaves and speculating based on what we do know. They couldn't have done this if they didn't have a good case to do it, and that the belief, at least the plausible belief, that Mar-a-Lago contained evidence of criminal activity. Now, attorney Mark Elias pointed out the media is missing the really big reason why the raid is a potential blockbuster in American politics. And that relates to 18 U.S. Code subsection 2071, the concealment, removal, and mutilation generally. And it says that if indeed one is found guilty of mishandling documents in this way, concealing, removing, mutilating, obliterating, the penalty is forfeiture of public office and disqualification from holding any office under the United States. That's potentially what is at play here, assuming that this involves the mishandling or unauthorized removal of classified information. And if they find those elements at Mar-a-Lago, the substance of the documents is less important. It's the fact that they were classified and that they were improperly removed. Their presence alone would be indicative of this crime. Now, again, we're going to get to clips in a moment of all the people saying everything done was improper. Merrick Garland would not have authorized this, and a federal judge would not have okayed it if there was not significant evidence to warrant it. And recall, with Hillary Clinton's case, the DOJ didn't prosecute because she may have been negligent with information. Maybe she was even reckless, but it was not an intentional mishandling that rose to criminality. And if this is what happened at Mar-a-Lago, we have to believe that at least potentially that is what the FBI believes Donald Trump did. Let's get now to MAGA world exploding over the FBI raiding Donald Trump's house. They are throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks. They're all going crazy. They're doing emergency podcasts. They're saying this is going to be the undoing of the Republic. It is a dystopian hellscape. It is over for the United States because of the FBI raiding Donald Trump. Let's look at some examples. These are great. Here's Mark Levin calling this one of the worst attacks on the Republic in modern history.
Now, you keep asking your guests, what's the justification? There is no justification. Oh. But what's he going to say tomorrow, the attorney general? Here's my guess. We've been negotiating with Trump and his lawyers since February when we found out they had this information. We were getting nowhere. And then we know, or we heard, that some documents were being destroyed. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times was on CNN. They've been running pictures of hers that she's going to have in the book of documents being flushed down a toilet. That doesn't mean a damn thing. It could be anything flushed down a toilet.
With Elise Stefanik's name on it. That's all it was.
Okay, but what I'm saying is you've asked, what would the pretext be?
Correct.
And so it is a pretext is exactly right. There is no justification for sending 30 friggin' FBI agents to the former president's compound in Mar-a-Lago in early morning and conducting themselves this way, or in any other cases in which they've done exactly the same thing. The FBI is corrupt. This guy Garland goes after parents. He goes after Republican state legislatures. He goes after states he disagrees with their abortion positions. He doesn't do a damn thing to protect the border, which is compelled by the Constitution. Nothing. So let's be clear. Newt is right. They're all right. This is the worst attack on this republic in modern history.
So Levin is flipping out. But the truth is, this would not have happened were there not significant I's dotted and T's crossed. Next, we go to Newsmax guest Bernie Kerik, not a guy unfamiliar with legal problems. And he said he's worried the next step is they're going to assassinate Donald Trump.
And I just put out a tweet about this. If you remember back in 2016, when right before he got elected, I was in Washington, D.C. I was at a couple different social events, and I heard people talking. They said the Democrats want this guy so bad that they wouldn't put assassination behind it. And I'm going to tell you something. They've tried impeachment. They've tried another impeachment. They've tried one investigation after another. This is about one thing. This is about stopping him from running in 2024. And I'm going to tell you something. I'm not into conspiracies. I'm not into anti-government rhetoric. This is the first time in my lifetime that I would say I am deathly afraid for Donald Trump. I would not put assassination behind these people.
Right. A raid based on probable cause, a warrant signed by a judge, and everything done properly could very clearly be a pretext to assassinating Donald Trump. Here's radical Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert saying this is the Gestapo.
Guys, I'm pissed. We are a nation of law and order, and this raid by the FBI on President Trump's home is totally un-American. This is Gestapo crap, and it will not stand.
Well, you know, I don't remember the Gestapo regularly having sworn affidavits, court orders signed by a judge, and all of it when they conducted raids. Many such examples, I think you understand. Alex Jones and Roger Stone convening an emergency podcast over the raid, likening it to Nazi Germany.
As a former political prisoner himself and what he believes this means. Roger Stone, thanks for joining us on this emergency broadcast.
It's an emergency.
Alex, it's a very, very sad day for America. This is the kind of thing you expect to see in Soviet Russia, Nazi Germany, communist Cuba.
They don't know how to handle this. Sean Hannity, we covered this last night on the live stream. He spoke for about 11 minutes without taking a breath. And here is some of his dystopian outlook on what took place.
First, a dark day for our republic, the Department of Justice, the rule of law, what looks to be potentially a shocking overreach. We'll find out in due time that will have serious ramifications potentially for many, many years to come.
A lot of potentialies in there, potentially doing very, very heavy lifting for Sean Hannity. Marjorie Taylor Greene now says on Twitter, quote, defund the FBI. Not exactly support the police type behavior by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And then lastly, right wing bomb thrower Dan Bongino saying that the left thinks this is all hilarious.
I just want to say in closing, listen, America, they're laughing at you. The left thinks this is hilarious. If you doubt me, just go to any of their goofy platforms, Twitter or elsewhere right now. They think this is hilarious.
Now, I have to tell you, Bongino is correct to a certain degree. I do think this is absolutely hilarious, but it also seems to be completely appropriate based on the facts that we have known for a very long time. No one that commits crimes against the American people should feel safe. And there's a lot of people that commit crimes and do feel safe because we have a two-tier justice system. We don't know where this will go, but we are going to follow it. And you've got to see Eric Trump's reaction to all of this. So in the midst of the FBI raid of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home and the right wing going apoplectic to try to figure out how can we attack what happened here today, Eric Trump, not known as Trump's smartest child, but that's okay. Eric Trump goes on Fox News and is so visibly triggered that he doesn't even know what he's saying, first starting with the epitome of the victimhood that the Trumps are the biggest victims in the United States.
You know, they went after him. They went after all of us. There's no family in American history that has taken more arrows in the back than the Trump family every single time. And
right. If you think of families who have been destroyed by simply having family members imprisoned due to having drugs, if you think of families who have lost children in mass shootings, if you think of families who can't even afford to feed their children. No, 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 no. It is the Trump family that has been the most victimized of any family. Then Eric Trump pulling everything out of the hat, bringing up Benghazi.
And going back to Hillary, there's a whole lot of other things. How about the Benghazi scandals? How about the Clinton Foundation? I mean, how many, you know, shady oligarchs from Russia were contributing to that? How about Uranium One? You want to talk about, you know, scandals that were never investigated, never vetted?
Yeah. You know, I remember, was it 8? Was it 12 investigations into Benghazi? Benghazi was a tragedy. It was horrible what happened. But Hillary's involvement was investigated up and down. She testified under oath for 8 hours, something Donald Trump has not done. Give me a break. Eric then goes on and says there wasn't even anything in the safe that they ransacked.
We get another subpoena, and they do it for one reason. because they don't want Donald Trump to run and win again in 2024. And Sean, that's what this is about today, to have 30 FBI agents, actually more than that, descend on Mar-a-Lago, give absolutely, you know, no notice, go through the gate, start ransacking an office, ransacking a closet. You know, they broke into a safe. He didn't even have anything in the safe.
Now, if there was nothing in the safe, that's almost more suspicious. I'd be wondering, where was the stuff moved to? Then lastly, Eric Trump saying, where did these FBI agents go anyway?
You know, shady deals with everybody around the world. And by the way, it's all on his laptop for the whole world to see. In his own writing, in his own words, corroborated by everybody. Where are these FBI agents? Where is everybody? Why? You know?
So Eric Trump, highly triggered and making no sense at all. Let's now allow some time to let this settle and develop. We will learn more about it, and we will see where it ultimately goes. What I want to ask you is, do you believe this is finally the levee breaking? Do you believe an indictment is coming? Let me know. Find me on Twitter at @DPacman. Could the coming 2022 midterm election be the worst midterm ever for Republicans in this particular situation? The situation being one that should be very good for the Republican Party. If you look historically, I know many of you are sick of hearing this from me, but I want to remind everybody, normally when one party takes the White House from the other party, in the first midterm election after that, that very party then loses a bunch of seats or potentially control of the House or Senate. Meaning, because Democrats took the White House from Republicans in 2020, 2022 should be very, very good for Republicans. And it was looking that way for a very long time. And all of a sudden, in the last month, and in particular in the last 2 weeks, things are looking dramatically different. We mentioned yesterday, the Senate has approved this Inflation Reduction Act bill to fight climate change and cut drug costs. This is a major accomplishment, assuming that the House passes it on Friday and then it is signed by Joe Biden, both of which are expected to happen. This is a massive Biden accomplishment. And then when you look bigger picture at the Biden accomplishments, you see that he did the COVID stimulus. He did the Infrastructure and Jobs Act. He confirmed the first Black female Supreme Court justice. He did some gun safety legislation, although I think it's pretty weak sauce, but at least it was something. He did the CHIPS Act for semiconductor manufacturing. The NATO expansion to include Finland and Sweden is in process. He expanded veterans' health care. He authorized the strike that killed terrorist Ayman al-Zawahiri, which, believe me, I understand there are legal questions about whether the United States can or should be doing that, but it is an accomplishment that Biden can claim. Fantastic jobs report last week, 3.5% unemployment, 55 straight days of gas price reduction, which, again, remember, I don't even think it has anything to do with Biden. I don't think the upswing had anything to do with Biden. I don't think the downswing has anything to do with Joe Biden either. But the point is, what is reported and what can you take credit for? And tomorrow, we have an inflation number coming out, which I expect to be significantly lower than the peak numbers we saw over the last few months. I may be wrong, but that's what I expect. And if that's the case, it will be another indicator that the economy is looking better and better overall. Could this be a disastrous midterm for Republicans? Well, the polling data is increasingly pointing that way. After looking for months and months like Republicans were going to take the Senate definitively from Democrats in the fall, the 538 forecast for the Senate now has Democrats at 59% likely to retain control of the Senate. Now, that's not overwhelming, but it is looking increasingly good for Democrats in terms of the Senate. Now, in the House, it's not looking very good. It still looks like about an 80% chance that Republicans win. Remember, 80% is not 100%, but that's the way that it is looking right now. This is a massive, massive reversal from the way things looked. And quite frankly, the way things should look, speaking historically for Republicans. What do you think we're going to see in November? And then the last piece of this is, We spoke about this a little bit with political scientist Rachel Bitticoffer last week. She has a slightly different view on it than I do, and I know many of you have different views about this. Because of the overturning of Roe v. Wade, this actually does seem like it is a midterm election where running on abortion rights, on women having autonomy over their medical decisions, could be very good for Democrats. Typically, it is not an issue that is so good for Democrats. Extraordinary circumstances. And as I've said before, there are some elections which just don't feel like they're that important. The 2022 midterm and the 2024 presidential election, which are honestly one and the same. I mean, the 24 election is almost getting going right now. And we're going to look at some of those numbers later as well, because what is happening with Trump and DeSantis is extraordinary. Could this be a disaster for Republicans? Let me know what you think. We've been covering what's going on in the Georgia Senate race. This is the race in which former football player Herschel Walker is the Republican nominee. He became the Republican nominee without even participating in a debate. And now the question is, will Herschel Walker debate Raphael Warnock? Raphael Warnock is the incumbent senator, a Democrat in Georgia. The backstory on Herschel Walker that has been notable is that he is almost unable to speak and almost unable to express himself and to give us his opinion on any issue. He's asked questions and he puts together word salads of no meaning whatsoever. And there are questions as to whether he is even going to debate Raphael Warnock. Recently, Herschel Walker has started to claim that he has accepted a debate. And the language, to the extent that we can decipher it, is bizarre. It's about a debate in Raphael Warnock's backyard. It's not going to be for the press, but it's going to be for the fans. And it's extraordinarily weird. And over the last week, we have confirmed that Herschel Walker still can't speak and probably won't debate. Here is one appearance over the weekend by Herschel Walker on Fox Business. And I gather he's talking about whether he will debate. But what he says is completely unintelligible. See if you can understand it.
November. Are you going to debate him?
Well, I've called him on two debates.
I've called him on two debates. What does that mean? It means nothing.
On two debates, he turned me down on both of them because I said, what I want to do is see a fair and equitable debate.
I have seen no evidence that Raphael Warnock has turned down two debates.
Where it's for the people, not about some press, not about some party, but the people get a chance to see the differences between my opponent and myself, where my opponent believe in raising taxes during a recession. My opponent believe being soft on crime. He voted with Joe Biden to elect officials that are soft on crime. My opponent believe that he voted to put men and
remember, the question was, are you going to debate?
In sports, where I do not think men should be in women's sports. So there's a big difference in contrast. I think he's afraid to stand in front of the Georgia voters and stand up for the record that he's voted on.
That is meaningless. Now, if there is such a debate, I will cover it. That would be an extraordinary debate to cover. But I am not getting the sense that Herschel Walker actually plans to debate. How could he debate if he can't even answer the question, are you going to debate? It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, he speaks with this very scrambled syntax. And it's almost like trying to decipher a verbal Morse code to listen to Herschel Walker. But again, I don't know why it was ever claimed that he agreed to a debate, because the more I listen to him, it sounds like he's maybe saying there's going to be a town hall. I don't really know. Here's another clip of Herschel Walker. I hesitate to use the word explaining, but he's talking, I guess, about this debate.
Senator Warnock, NextStar Media Group, offered to host a debate for us in Savannah.
Now, by the way, these are the new videos that Walker's doing, very clearly reading off of some kind of notes. Even reading off of the notes, I still don't know what the hell he's talking about.
October the 14th in front of the people. Don't be scared. I know you rejected previous offers I made.
No evidence of that.
But please consider this one. This debate is more than fair to you, and it's for the people. It's in your own backyard, Savannah.
Right.
You have hometown advantage. It's being hosted by a respected third-party media group with multiple outlets in Georgia. It will be aired statewide on broadcast television.
By the way, NextStar is like this right-wing media company. I'm sure they would host a debate, but again, nobody knows what Walker is talking about.
In prime time, so everybody will get a chance to watch it, is a prime time showdown in Savannah. You know I'm in. Come on, Raphael. Let's do this for Georgia. October the 14th. I'll be there. Will you?
Yeah. It sort of sounds like what Walker wants to do is some kind of town hall. It's not even clear what he's talking about, to be perfectly frank. But I have to tell you, when Trumpists are your supporters, there's no downside to Walker just saying, I want a debate and Raphael Warnock won't do it. And of course, it'll be a made up lie. Warnock might be perfectly willing to debate. In fact, I believe he is. But what Walker should do, if I were his advisors, I would not want him to debate. I mean, he can't speak. So how can you debate? I would advise him, start claiming that Warnock won't debate you. Make it up. It'll be a lie. I think that actually is his best strategy. And a lot of his followers will believe it. Let me know your thoughts. And we'll have these clips on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. It is great to welcome to the program today Andrew Sullivan, who's a blogger at The Weekly Dish. His book, now out in paperback, is Out on a Limb, Collected Writing from 1989 to 2021. You know, Andrew, it's so great to have you on because as a progressive, my very left-wing audience will say, who on the right is interesting to listen to because I'm not getting what I need intellectually from Matt Gaetz, for example. And I will often say, you know, I actually think Andrew Sullivan writes a lot of really interesting things. But the strange thing is, I see very little in common at this point between you and sort of where the American Republican Party is. I mean, do you feel like you still see your politics in that party?
I've never seen my politics in that political party. Never identified as a Republican, have been pretty hostile to successive Republican presidents. I mean, Bush and Trump, for example, a big supporter of Obama. No, my view is really from a more English conservative position of limited government, free society, skepticism about grand changes to society in general, and a belief in the West and its core values. And that meant that I did not have a huge problem, for example, in supporting Barack Obama, whom I regarded as a bit of a moderate, a bit of an old school. Actually, I always thought of him as a 1970s kind of Republican. Mm-hmm. And so I don't fit in, is the truth. But I am definitely not a lefty, and I'm definitely not a liberal in the progressive sense. I'm a skeptic of those traditions.
When you look at, to pick something specific, the increased willingness from the modern American right wing to use government power to achieve whatever it is they're looking to achieve, rather than stepping back into what might be called small government conservatism, doing the absolute least, does that concern you above and beyond just, you know, whether you identify with the movement or not, because it's antithetical to the way you believe governments should operate? Or is it not as broad a concern as some more traditional conservatives point out?
I think that at some level, you know, the right, in terms of the culture war particularly, does have a right to self-defense. I mean, I don't think that's completely outrageous. I don't think it's outrageous, for example, that we should have states decide what their abortion regime is going to be through democratic processes. I don't think it's crazy for a state, for example, to look at its own educational curricula and positions. And if it's that has been altered dramatically in ways that the politics of the state doesn't quite accept, then I don't think it's out of bounds for a governor or school boards to do, within the classic democratic tradition, a change of policy or a reversal of policy. But I do think there's a sense of using the state as a wielding sort of a weapon to punish people. So, for example, let me give you DeSantis is perfectly within his rights to say No, in Florida, we are going to, through the legislature, change curriculum and pass this law. It's another thing for him then to use the power of the governor to punish a company, Disney, for disagreeing with him. So there's a distinction there. And I think sometimes it can get muddled up. I don't think the right has to constantly disarm, but I do think the right has lost a sense of the limits of government, the need to let society evolve on its own, and to be tolerant of other points of view and allow them their place in the sun. And that goes for both sides, by the way. And I think a great deal of the pushback from the right on some of these cultural issues is a response to aggressive acts by the progressive left.
When it comes to democratically deciding abortion law at the state level, like you mentioned, Kansas had an actual vote of the people, of the population. Other states like Indiana, it's legislators who got together and said, we're banning it after, I think, 6 weeks is the latest proposal, with very, very few exceptions. One could argue that that's democratic in the sense that it's legislators elected by the people who are deciding that, but it runs counter to public opinion as best we can tell at this point in time. So are both of those examples of democratically deciding, or is only when the people vote an example of that?
Well, I think the Kansas thing was a very particular question because they'd already had some sort of decision barring that made some kind of vote,
yes,
as a referendum inevitable. Look, no, I don't think it really matters how that democracy is pursued. It may be that in the short term, for example, there are lots of people in Republicans elected at state legislatures who are more to the right on abortion than most of their voters are.
Absolutely.
Well, vote them out or let your views be known to them to make sure they're not following some pre-existing ideological commitment, which, you know, for many years, it was so easy for Republicans to say, I'm for banning all abortion, period. And they were never called on it because no one was ever going to be enforcing it. Now that it's having to be enforced, I think you're going to get actual real compromises and decisions that are made state by state. And I think liberals, or pro-life, pro-choices in general, are way too pessimistic about their chances in that process. And I think we'll probably end up in the U.S. pretty not that far away from many countries in Western Europe. And although we will have some outliers on the conservative front, but, you know, America is more conservative than parts of Europe. And I don't have a problem with states coming to different positions on questions like that.
The other, because we're talking about a lot of cultural and social issues, it was notable to me, I've sort of seen this building and look in watching Trump rallies over the last year to 18 months, but it was very notable at CPAC that the biggest applause lines were the more overtly homophobic and transphobic lines. Jokes about pronouns. I don't have the full list in front of me, but when you saw the crowd really get excited, they were dead when Trump was talking about himself as the biggest victim in the history of Western civilization. That did not excite the crowd too much. But the stuff about trans swimmers and Ted Cruz's pronouns, and there, it really excited the crowd. Do you agree that there's been a sort of resurgence of that sentiment in the modern American right? And are you concerned about it?
I think I am, within some aspects of the conservative right. I mean, we're talking about the Texas CPAC.
Yes.
So we are talking about the pretty hardcore fanatics. And they are so polarized that anything pro-gay, for example, gets attacked. But when you actually look at the polling data of regular Republicans, you now see a majority of Republicans favoring marriage equality. What I do think you're seeing is an understandable response to a very aggressive push by essentially queer and gender critical theorists to redefine what sex is, to redefine what gender is, and to teach those redefinitions to 3 to 4 year olds without their parents even being informed. And I think that has led to a backlash. I honestly think it's understandable it's led to a backlash. And there are plenty of us who are very supportive of gay and trans rights who are not nonetheless wedded to this rather postmodern understanding that biological sex is basically non-existent, that you pick and choose whichever gender you have, and that there are more than 55 different genders to pick from, and that all of them trump sex in every particular instance. I don't buy any of that. And I think insofar as there's been resistance to it, it's been a function of the left overreaching rather than the right demonstrating its intolerance. That's not to say I defend some of this stuff.
Well, I mean, some of the things you just said, I'm also against. I've just not seen them being taught to 4-year-olds anywhere. I mean, where, and I'm not saying this rhetorically, like, where are they teaching 4-year-olds that there is no biological basis at all for gender and that there's 55 choices to be made? I just haven't seen that.
Well, I recommend you check a couple of pieces I've done recently at the Weekly Dish on this. State curricula are now mandating places that were, as in Florida, as in New Jersey, and there are other places, with that gender identity and homosexual and sexual orientation be taught from kindergarten onwards. Now, how that is translated is a different question, but I can also show you plenty of children's books, plenty of lesson plans in which this is argued for as early as 3 or 4. And what they say, of course, they're not using words like biological sex, or they're saying, and this is the phrase that comes across quite starkly to me, this is to a child who at kindergarten, you can be a boy or a girl or both or neither or something else entirely. And it's up to you to choose. Well, I think telling 3-year-olds that before they've even wrapped their heads around boy and girl seems to me outrageously over the top, and certainly not something a lot of gay people even think should be taught, and certainly affects gay kids who themselves have a slightly different perspective, which is that, yes, we're boys, but we just happen to be attracted to other boys. Now, they will not be aware of that in any real sense at 3, 4, 5. I don't see there's a problem with restricting it to kids who are 8 years old or above. And I don't think that's some sort of fascist move. I think the ideologues got out of control and they're being slightly reined back in. And I don't think that's the end of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to respond substantively because I just haven't seen what you're describing. So I'll do some research on that.
Look at the books.
Yeah.
Because they're really... There are ways in which you translate it to children. And I think it can be rather disorienting for children to be taught this that young.
As a political question, what would you like to see the American right, whether it's through the Republican Party or outside of it, wherever you follow it, what should be the substance of the platforms on which those candidates run? Because especially in the Trump era, they don't even really pretend to be about economic policy. They'll vaguely talk about taxes and regulation, but there's very little substance there. What substance is it? This stuff, the stuff about what 4-year-olds are taught, because that seems sort of flimsy as well as a platform.
It is flimsy as a platform. But I do think there is a potent policy mix that's on the table. And that is for the Republican Party to go left on economics, to do things like supporting, like take the pro-life position. If they actually got their act together and decided to really fund healthcare for pregnant women, that they actually did put some beef behind support for bringing children into the world, along with more restrictions on abortion, then I think they'd have a fairer hearing, at least. And I think moving left on economics in terms of trade, I think moving right on immigration, and that combination with a certain amount of cultural, not right-wingery, but conservatism, in the sense that we don't really want to redefine gender. We don't want to suddenly decide that everyone has to overcome whiteness in order to become a fully functioning member of society, those kinds of things. I think that's a very potent platform. It's potent in Europe, and it would be potent here if it hadn't been consumed by all this awful authoritarian instincts, by the cult worship of Trump, by the anti-institutional, anti-conservative radicalism of many of these groups. And I think there is a center there, a center right, that will be made anew in the new world around nationalism, around trade, around immigration, but that could be sane and would work very well. And unfortunately, I think the Republican Party seems currently incapable of coming up with that.
Is there anybody right now that embodies that? I mean, who, when you, I know you don't like Trump. My guess is you're not big on DeSantis. Are there people currently in politics in the U.S. that match this ideology that you're talking about?
Well, look, DeSantis has a certain edge to him, and he's posing as Trump, essentially, at this point.
Yes.
But when you look at his early time in Florida, when you look at, for example, he's been quite sensible and pragmatic on climate change in terms of resilience in Florida, has been doing quite a lot of sane stuff on the environment. I think if you could get past the personality cult of someone like Trump, and I think if you could start delivering, so for example, if Trump had actually delivered on his wall, even though he didn't, I do think you could have a more successful presidency than you did with Trump. But Trump is just sui generis. He is a crazy person. He has attacked this country's institutions and its democracy. He should not be anywhere near political office. So from my point of view, unless that is resolved, I can't support anything Republican. But if a Republican were to emerge who would actually acknowledge and recognize our constitutional order, he can reform the institutions, but not destroy them, and create a policy agenda that is more left economically and more right socially, then that's a perfectly decent outcome for the future of the right in America. The question is, who can do it? I think, to be honest with you, I have an open mind about whether DeSantis is that person or whether he is not that person. And we'll see.
People like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney, what's your perspective on them?
I have what we call newfound respect for Liz Cheney. I do think that what she's done has required courage and integrity, and I think she's right. I really do. I think Mitt Romney's move on supporting family life and the economic stresses of young families with kids who are struggling to get by is also very positive. It seems to me that until we get rid of Trump, someone like Liz Cheney is not going to be a player. But she's got a long life, and we don't know what happens. But I'm very happy. I don't know about you, but when I look back at my worry about Romney in 2012, I'm like, Jesus, give me Romney any day of the week now. He would be far preferable to these nutballs. And he's a good guy. You know, at some point, just someone who respects the rule of law and the Constitution and says so publicly is such a relief on the Republican side.
No, I know what you mean. I recently rewatched this Netflix documentary about Romney's, I believe it was the 2012 run. And without, you know, rehabilitating his policies specifically, which I preferred Obama at the time, but it's hard to feel like it would have been a crisis if Mitt Romney had won in 2012 in the way that we've seen in the last 4 years, because he seems so comparatively benign and inoffensive.
There are two things here. You can disagree with someone's policies.
Yeah.
That's what democracy is, right?
Right.
You vote for the other guy. But when you lose trust in that person's respect for the system, for the institutions, and for the rule of law, it's something else entirely. Since Trump became the nominee, we have been in a different world. We have been in a democratic emergency because this is someone at the center of our system who despises our system and who will seek to undermine it, doesn't even understand it. So putting that aside, it would be lovely to get back to a really good debate about policy.
Right.
How do we best protect the environment? You know, I mean, and the current bill, for example, is a bit of a hodgepodge, isn't it? But it's a decent hodgepodge. It's a compromise that moves things forward. And the same with abortion in the States, even though you may hate the idea it's being done, it's still a process, a political process. Find a compromise, move things forward in a way. And that's all liberal democracy should be about. We're not about solving every human problem. We're about making things a bit better if we can. And I want to kind of dial back these existential claims about what politics can do and get back to the difficult, unsatisfying, but absolutely phenomenally important compromising, legislating. And I think that the current Congress, after a rough start, has begun to hit its stride on that.
I agree.
I'll be very interested to see how the public responds.
Yeah.
Because I think the public wants this. I really do. Even though it won't solve everything, it shows that we can do something. And I hope that's rewarded.
Yeah, and some of the polling data over the last 2 months suggests that things are looking different for a midterm than they would historically be expected to look. We'll have to wait 2.5 months now and see. The book now out in paperback is Out on a Limb, collected writing from 89 to 2021. We've been speaking with blogger Andrew Sullivan, whose work you can read at The Weekly Dish. So great having you on.
Thanks so much for having this conversation. I'm really, really grateful to be part of it.
Okay, a couple of other quick stories that we've been covering. The Alex Jones text messages have made their way to the Trump Riot Committee based on reporting from a number of different sources. So let's back up and remind you what's going on. We knew before the Alex Jones defamation trial that Jones was involved and in contact with people that were organizing and at the Trump riots on January 6, 2021. We knew that it would be great if Alex Jones was somehow more involved and under scrutiny from the January 6 committee, but it wasn't clear if and how that was going to happen. Then the Alex Jones defamation trial took place. And as you might remember, Alex Jones' own boneheaded lawyer accidentally sent a full digital copy of Jones' entire mobile phone, including text messages and other things, to the attorney representing the plaintiffs in the defamation trial. And there was cartoonish stuff in there. Like, for example, there was a record of Alex Jones sending, according to the plaintiff's attorney, Alex Jones sent a naked picture of his own wife to Roger Stone, like bizarre cartoonish stuff. But also because of the timeline of those text messages in that digital copy, it was reasonable to believe or to expect or to wonder that materials related to January 6th also would have been on that digital copy. And then we learned the January 6th committee wants Alex Jones' text messages. And now the reporting from CNN is Alex Jones' texts have been turned over to the January 6th committee. The article reads, approximately 2 years worth of text messages sent and received by conspiracy theorist Alex Jones have been turned over to the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection, a person familiar with the matter said to CNN. The messages were handed over to the committee by Mark Bankston, the attorney who represented the Sandy Hook parents, who successfully sued Jones in Texas and won nearly $50 million in the civil trial. Bankston would only tell CNN that he is cooperating with the committee. The committee declined to comment. During the trial, as you might recall, Bankston revealed one of Jones' lawyers messed up and inadvertently sent him the 2 years of text messages that Bankston and Bankston also said during the trial, the committee expressed interest in the material. You know, it's a really good thing that so many of the people behind January 6th, involved in January 6th, and in this case, representing individuals involved with January 6th, speaking, of course, of Alex Jones' attorney, are kind of doofuses. It's very useful and it aids the investigation to proceed that a lot of these people don't seem to be playing with a full deck or, you know, the wheel is spinning, but the hamster's dead, whatever metaphor or phrase you want to apply to it. Now, none of this means that there are going to be consequences. I think as we now have learned of the FBI raid of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home, it's entertaining. It feels like at least he's suffering a little because they raided his home. But I am not assuming that Trump is going to be indicted or that if he is, that there will be consequences. We will have to wait and see. And similarly, the fact that the committee now has the text messages of Alex Jones, even though it was not Jones' intention for the committee to have them, doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be consequences. Now, one of the things that is important to remember is anytime you're dealing with leaks or transfers of information, the right wingers love to pull this double standard. When it came to the Hunter Biden laptop, they didn't care how the blind computer tech got it. They didn't care about anything in terms of due process or discovery or finding it. It didn't matter. It was what's on the laptop. Now they're saying, what? Well, hold on a second. What about due process? This was an accident. What about attorney-client privilege? What about invasion of privacy? What about free speech? They'll throw whatever they can at the wall to say the content of the text messages does not matter. All that matters is how did the January 6th committee obtain the text messages? Predictable people. We will see what happens and what the next step is in terms of the committee and Alex Jones. Remember, the committee expected to hold more hearings. I believe they said in September, so we will see. One little final follow-up from the weekend CPAC. This is Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin is fascinating. We have covered Sarah Palin for a really long time because back in 2008, she was the late Senator John McCain's vice presidential running mate. And at the time, she became known to us for her incomparable word salads and her abject failure at using language to communicate. She just couldn't do it. You saw her mouth moving. You heard things coming out. Some of them were words, but it didn't fit together in any way that made sense. It's sort of like if you made a dish for dinner and like you see a plate and you're aware that there's pasta in the toilet and you saw tomato sauce on top of the fridge. Like individually, these are elements of food, but it's not coming together in any way that makes sense. Now, similarly, when Sarah Palin appeared at CPAC over the weekend, she was apparently trying to quote Abraham Lincoln, and she is so visibly confused and so incoherently trying to use language that I don't know what the hell she's talking about. It also looks like she has a massive, gaudy Star of David hanging from her neck. I mean, every aspect of this is whacked, and whatever is going on with her seems to be getting worse and worse. Maybe she was referring to a Lincoln log. I don't know, but this doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard Lincoln say.
And what they're doing is usurping the power from the other two branches of government, the judiciary and the legislative branch. We can't allow that to happen. Things like that that create this atrophy in the foundation of America will destroy America. It's like Lincoln said, we're not going to be destroyed from foreign forces coming on in. It's going to be from within. If we allow things that are so anti-constitutional to be...
What we're going to do right here is go back, way back, back into time. When the only people that existed were troglodytes, cavemen, cave women. Neanderthal, troglodytes. Let's take the average caveman at home, listening to his cereal.
All right, welcome aboard. Back at it again, Zombo's Deep Archive. Going back into time. Today, we are getting back to July the 24th, 13 years ago, 2009. And let's see what I was doing back then. Probably not too dissimilar from what I'm doing now or what I'll be doing tomorrow. Tomorrow is my regular show, Zombo in Your Brain, right here on this here station, WRCT, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. But boy, I sure do enjoy going back into time and listening to these shows from 13 years ago. They're so crispy. They're well preserved. They're like a can of Pringles. So let's open up that can and dig into July the 24th, it'll be so nice, a nice picnic, July 24th, 13 years ago, get some Pringles, and okay, I got to get into the show. All right, Zombo in Your Brain.